go ahead and get started. I have a few announcements slash clarifications, I guess. I got some emails about not being able to find problem set one. I think understandably some of you look on Blackboard. I apologize if this came to you, that I also have a separate website. I do that because Blackboard is, one, very clunky, and two, it disappears a few months after I teach the class, and I like actually having it around, so I use my own server in sort of an archival way. And so, sorry about that, but not really, you're stuck with it. So that's, it's actually posted on the class website if you found that confusing, so you should... if you don't know where that is, you should find it, because that's where lots of things will be posted. The majority of things will be posted there. Another announcement is that we had a workshop section scheduled during lecture. I will not argue that perhaps that could be a better use of your time. I don't know. May depend a little on the workshop and the day of the lecture. But that said, I sort of figured it's bad form to schedule the workshop during lecture. So that one's not going to happen. And we basically changed the time of that to 10 to noon. And you should feel free to go into your access or whatever and change your workshop section to this section if you wish, or if something's opened up in a section that you like better for your time, go ahead and do that. Okay. If there's a section that's already full and you have a section, you can't move to it, because the whole idea is that the workshop gets broken if we have too many people in the room. The point of workshop is for you to feel very comfortable to ask questions and confess your ignorance about things. And anecdotally, that breaks at about 13 people in the room. I don't know why it feels better to be stupid if there's 12 people in the room, but if there's 20 people in the room, nobody wants to open their mouth. So whatever. So feel free to move. I don't actually remember what I wrote in the syllabus. I may have said you want to hand in your problem set to a Physics 114 locker, which is down by 106. What I decided to do, and whether I did it, that made that decision in time to put in the syllabus or not, I don't remember. What I decided to do this time is to actually have you put your problem sets in a locker that is the locker that correlates to the name of the TA who runs your section, so that they will look over your problem sets and do the record keeping. So you know who to go to if you have an issue. Also, the fact that they can check in on that and they're working with you in workshop sections, they may actually be able to give you some feedback that you would never get if I have it all collectively. So the problem, the potential problem with that is I have yet to map the sections for the leaders. When I have 11 people involved in all these sections, just finding out everybody's availability and then doing the map turns out to be a big deal. So I hope to complete that earlier this week, and if so, then you will know which leader I'll post for you. You will know which leader corresponds to the section that you signed up for. And that would be the person whose box you would want to put it in. And the boxes are across from 106 down in Gaussian Lump. Just a set of lockers. If I don't actually get this finalized, then you won't have that mapping, and I'll give you a plan B. I'll just tell you which person's box to stuff it in. Okay? Okay, so last time, one of the things we did was we talked about how the course will run. And in the intervening time, I'm wondering if any of you have any burning questions you wanted to ask about that. Wow. Okay, that's probably a first. Okay, so we also started talking about the main subject of the class. We started talking about the electrostatic force, is really what we typically call. So that would be the electric force, where we look at things, which would be sort of the force between electric charges, whatever that is, and we're looking at the case where they're not moving, so we call it static. This is a course in electromagnetism, so you may wonder why I call this the electric force. And that is, if you go out in nature and just start fiddling around with things, you actually see sort of evidence for two distinct forces. If you have magnets, you know, they will, one magnet can exert a force on another, and you can observe that. But that's different from what happens if you rub your hands, you take your cat, you rub him on your head, and you put him on the wall, right? That's a different force. The shocks you get when you remove clothes from the laundry, if you've ever done that, that would be electrostatics. So if you go out in the world, you sort of see evidence for these two different forces. And so we need to look at them separately, at least initially. And then a lot of the fun in this class is, why in the world do we ever talk about electromagnetism in the first place? You know, why is it that you may not have actually heard of them as being distinct forces? Because in reality, when you first look at things in nature, they really are quite distinct. So we'll talk about electric force and magnetic force. So last time I was talking about sort of similarities between something you've already seen and you're an expert on, gravitation, and this electrostatic force. So in gravitation, you have a force that is along the line joining two particles that have a charge, which we call mass. And this mass comes with only one algebraic sign, which is the mathematical way of modeling the force, saying that it's only attractive. So we write down, we quantify the force of gravitation between two masses as this GMM over R squared. So it's proportional to these charges. It's inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. This G is the number that basically sets the scale for how strong this force is in a given system of units. And this R hat tells you it's along the direction of the vector that joins the two masses. This minus sign is the thing that defines it to be an attractive force. Right? If this is the R, and I'm asking what is the force of this big M on that little M, it's in the minus R hat direction, so it's toward the big M. So electrostatics basically is the same, except when you go out into the world, it's not chiseled on any stone tablets that somebody found on the mountain. When you go out in the world and you look, you find that this thing that we're calling the electric force can be both repulsive and attractive. So the simplest way to model that mathematically is to take this same basic, well, we also find that it's proportional to the amount of charge and inverse square. So there's a lot of similarities between these two forces. And it's a vector force that is along the line that joins the two charges. The simplest way to model this in terms of knowing that it can be repulsive and attractive is to imagine that there are two types of charge, a positive charge and a negative charge. And you can most simply quantify that by having the algebraic sign of the charge be that. So that means when I multiply these two charges, I can get, if it's same sign charge, then I have a net positive thing, and this then turns out to be repulsive. The force of big Q on little Q is a long R hat, which is going out that way, so it would be a repulsive force. If these are opposite charges, opposite algebraic signs, the net thing here is negative, and then the force is pulling in toward big Q. Okay? So this law is what we call Coulomb's law. That's what this guy gave us back in about 1785. So a couple of notes that are a couple of things worth noting. I guarantee you on an exam that at some point I will give you something that will demand that you understand that the force that we're talking about is a vector force. It's a force. All forces are vectors. You have done vector force addition since about the second day of Physics 113. Okay? And this is the same. So when I put things in two dimensions, you need to take components and stuff just like you would if there were a mechanics problem. Alright? And I'm guaranteeing you that I will do something that evaluates that you actually understand in Coulomb's law you have to worry about vectors and components. Because invariably, some of you don't get that. So I will always ask you that. So I'm telling you this now so that you all get that. And when you all begin to get that, then I'll stop telling you this and you won't never mind. Anyway, the other thing to point out is that we have to measure charge in some way. You know, anything that we're measuring has to come with units so that you can be very precise about what you need. And the MKS system of units, we say that the charge is measured in coulombs after Mr. Coulomb that you saw on the last page. And the symbol is a C. This C is very distinct from the symbol for the speed of light, which is C, the symbol for heat capacity, which is C, and the symbol for capacitance, which you'll use, which is also C. And you need to be able to know the difference between these C's. C? Alright. Sorry about that. I guess we just don't have enough letters. But for whatever reason, it's not as bad as it sounds because context usually tells you which ones we're talking about. But if I get really inventive, I'll try to create a problem for you at some point where we have all of the C's in the same problem, and we'll see what happens with that. It could be a lot of fun, probably more fun for me than you. Okay, so another nice thing about this is because it's too similar to gravity and you're much too used to it, we have to add a little complication. So you'll note that in Coulomb's law, instead of G, we have a quantity K. And of course we don't have G because it's not gravity, it's a different force, so we have to have its strength is different. You know, again, this K is not something that was chiseled in stone and found on a mountain. It's something people go and measure, okay? And so it's something we figure it out, and it turns out to be this number if you're in the MKS system. Okay. That is altogether too simple, so we often rewrite it this way as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And we give epsilon naught a really cool name, which is called permittivity of free space. And when you take this number and rewrite it this way and you ask what is epsilon naught, you get this number. Okay? The units are different because it's down here instead of up here. The name, it does look cool, doesn't it? Can tell people, what'd you learn today? I learned about permittivity of free space, Mom. And see, you know, Mom will be all impressed. And you should always do something like that for your parents so that they think you're doing something useful. You laugh. I got this great email once. I had a student in Physics 113, I think it was. And I got this absolutely, you know, sometimes you get something and it's like the excitement was just bubbling out of this email. This student had been driving along with his mom on a snowy day, and the car went in a ditch. And they couldn't get the car out of the ditch. You couldn't push the car out of the ditch. So they tried tying a rope to the bumper and pulling it, and they couldn't get the car out of the ditch. And this kid said, wait a second. So he goes, here's a tree, here's the car in a ditch or whatever. He ties the rope to the tree and he pushed this way, which means the tensions are like that and this is going to be bigger than he could pull, right? because of the geometry, because of my hand hit the wrong thing. Because of the geometry, if you think about it in physics 13 sort of way, the tension in this rope is going to be much greater than this force with which he's pushing it. And the car popped right out of the ditch. And I read the email, I'm like, really? And I'm starting to write this, and he's all, and it's just because you gave us that problem. And I was like, wow, I did something useful. He's very excited. So he said he went home, and his parents were just so excited, and they were literally like, it's just so good to see we're not wasting your tuition money. So sometimes it's even useful. Okay, so it's a vector force, and it's inverse square, so sometimes it's good to play with things like that. Let's see if I have this, yeah. So what you'll find on the class website is a link under some Java applets that I had made that I found gave useful visualizations for a number of things which we're gonna cover in this class. And this is the first one that you're going to see. Imagine that we have a particle. Very often in physics, especially in this class, we talk about test particles. Think of a test particle as usually a particle with a unit positive charge, and you just mentally pop it down somewhere and look at what happens to it. And we use that as sort of a probe to see basically what's happening with the electric force at a certain position in space. So we think of this as our test particle. In this particular applet, you can change its charge, but let's leave it as one at the moment. And then let's see what happens to it if we add some other charged particle. And what you'll see is that there is a force that's on our test particle due to this blue charge. And it is of a certain size and along the direction that joins them. And notice what happens if I move the blue particle toward the black particle. The force grows in strength, and it will go, if you look and quantitatively measure it, you'll find it grows the inverse square of the distance. So if I move it twice as close, it's a four times larger force. And then you can add other particles. And you'll note that the blue vector is then the force that the blue particle is exerting on the black particle. This is the force that the orange particle is exerting on the black particle. This particle doesn't really feel this force or that force in and of itself. What it feels is the net vector superposition of those two things. So this particle, for example, if we let them all go, would go that direction. Right. And it would accelerate given its mass according to the size of whatever that force is. So you can have lots of fun with these. You can add other particles, you can change them, etc. It's easy to pull up on the web late night at a frat party if you're so in the mood. It's actually very cool after a couple of years. So have fun with it. But if you have any issues with sort of this whole idea of vector superposition, then you want to sort of work those out. There's a problem that you'll just begin to run into here, which is in mechanics, this is a lot easier to visualize usually because you have, you know, Tom is pushing the sled, and so the force is sort of along the arm. Or Sally is pulling on the rope, right? So you've got that thing that helps you visualize the direction in which these forces are going. And you don't have that in electromagnetism. So you have to create mental models all the time. So what you'll see is a bunch of charges sitting there, and you have to now mentally go, okay, this one is pulling this way, this one is pushing that way, and then, you know, and go ahead and sketch it out or whatever, but you won't have the ropes to guide you. The other thing is with a rope, if I'm pulling on the rope, I know what the force is on the far side, right, because it's pulling. But with charges, if it's charge, it repels it, and the negative charge is attracting it, right? So you have to pay attention to what the relative signs of the charges are and get the directions right. You okay with this? All right, so it's pretty easy to visualize. I mean, as you know from mechanics, it can be painful because you have to now resolve the components of the vectors and add them up and all that kind of stuff, right? So three-dimensional problems sort of break down into three separate problems that you have to figure out. So it can be sort of painful, but it's really no more difficult than stuff you guys are already pros at. Okay, so I was just reminding myself to do this. It shows up. Alright. So I have up here something which we call an electroscope. And the electroscope consists of a metal conductor. That is basically shaped like this, that has a gold foil, which just hangs. Okay? When I say a conductor, that has a very specific meaning in physics. That means that the electric charge moves freely, whatever it is. It's just a material where there exists electric charge, and if I put a force on that electric charge is free to move in response to it. That would be a conductor. So what happens, what we do with this, is if we imagine the conductor is made up of, it's neutral, so it has an equal amount of positive and negative charges that make it up in some way. So if I now approach this thing with something that has, say, a huge positive charge, then what that will do is it will attract the negative charges that are in this conductor, and it will repel the positive charges that are in the conductor. So what will happen is that you'll have a migration of charges within this conductor because the charges are free to move. So you'll have sort of negative charges coming up toward the positive charge, and you'll have positive charges being pushed down. So what will happen And I don't want to hear that I was drawing sexually explicit things in class. This is just physics. You will get sort of the positive charge will be pushed away like this, the negative charge up here. And note that the thin foil is very, very light. And because it's conducting as well, the positive charge comes down on here and here, and now this repels itself. So the more charge I put on it, the higher the gold foil will rise. What you see is flip because of the optics. So here is the conductor that's hanging down, here is the gold foil. Okay? And you can think of that being up. In this, all right. So now, let's suppose I start with something that is electrically neutral, which I'm not sure I am because I said that. If I come sort of close to this, nothing happens. All right. Now let's say I have some material, whatever it is. I rub it with some other material, and now the electro affinity of the two materials may be different. You've done a lot of chemistry, so that means basically. Materials are more inclined to hold on to the electrons than some other materials. So if I rub the two, then I'll transfer some charge from one thing to another. It's a way of sort of in the laboratory just creating some arbitrary amount of charge. So now this is charge. I don't even know what sign. But now look what happens as I begin to approach this conductor due to this. Is that cool? That's just sort of neat. Now, watch this. I come with the other thing. Same thing happens. And you can't see the charge, but what's happening is instead of pushing, say, the positive charge down, it's now pushing the negative charge down because it's an opposite charge. I can deposit charge on it like that, and now I pull away, and you'll note that it's staying on there. Now look what happens if I take the opposite charge thing and I approach it. That's cool, right? Yeah, so what we're doing there is when I deposit all the charge on it, then here we are, say, let's just say it's all positive charge all over the thing, and now when I approach it with something that's negative, it starts to attract the positive charge up, which pulls positive charge off of here, which is going to cause it to lower, right? So it's a game that sort of shows that we have a force that allows things to be both repulsive and attractive. Okay? And you can begin to see that you can even quantify it in some way, right? If I only rub the rod a little bit, or I'm far away, then it's only going to push the thing up a little bit. If I go very close, or I have a whole lot of charge, it pushes it up a lot. So you can even imagine this is sort of the kernel of something you could make as a device in the laboratory to measure charge. So. All right. Do you believe? All right. That's good. It's for real. I think sometimes when you get so used to just doing these crappy problems, you forget that we're actually talking about reality. Okay? That's where these equations come from. So, if you did an experiment that showed it behaves differently, what's cool about science is the equation changes. Okay? It's not about truth, it's about experimental methods. Okay. So, a couple of other things that, again, probably tell us something really fundamentally important about reality, but again, are something that we just happen to see when we go and look. It doesn't have to be this way. One is that electric charge is conserved. What does that mean? What does it mean when you say energy is conserved? Yeah.
Can't be created or destroyed.
Can't be created or destroyed. Yeah, so this is similar to that. So we can actually create and destroy charge, but we can't change the net charge in whatever it is. Right? So I could, out of nothing, create a positive and a negative charge. Or if a process happens, you know, whatever the charge is that you start with has to be the charge you end with. Okay, in terms of the net. Everything might have all gotten all jiggled around. Okay, the particles may have totally changed in the meantime. But if you were to measure all that you start with and all that you end with, you get the same number. Doesn't really have to be that way. But it apparently is. And probably, if we ever really and truly understand it, this is a very fundamental clue about something very basic about the universe. I've known some theorists who did some stuff like string theorists who, you know, they sort of think they actually understand this. I don't know. But it's a fact, it seems. There's another thing about electric charge. Is that it's quantized. What I mean by that? It comes in units, of which there is a smallest unit. And the unit is generally given the symbol E. I put absolute value signs here because technically the charge of the electron is negative, but when we talk about the quantization of electric charge, you sort of want to think of it as positive. If you were to go and take an electron and you somehow can measure the size of its charge, in the units that we're using, what you would get is that this is equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. And if you go out in nature and you measure any other free particle that exists that you can get your hands on, you will find that the electric charge that those particles have, it could be zero, all right? Or it will be this, or it will be a multiple of this. All right? I don't know why, it just is. I'm lying to you a little bit. I'm not lying about what I just said, but I did have a weasel word in there. I said a free particle. We have experimental evidence that's very strong that there exists particles which have fractional units of charge, and we call those particles quarks. And we give them stupid names. So the up quark, the down quark, the charm quark, the strange quark, the top quark, and the bottom quark. Those are the six quarks for which we have direct experimental evidence. And of these particles, these three have a charge of plus 2/3 times E. And these three have a charge of minus 1/3 times E. And these quarks are held together by a force which is different from just the electromagnetic force. There is an electromagnetic force that holds them together, but there's another force of nature which we will talk very little about. Maybe this is all we'll talk about in this course, which is called the strong nuclear force. And in that force, it's much, much stronger than the force of electromagnetism. And it binds the quarks together. And this force, the strong force, is a very bizarre force in that if I take two particles that feel that force and I kick them really hard so that I try to blast one away from the other. In other words, suppose I have a particle that contains quarks. And you're very familiar with particles that contain quarks. For example, protons are made up of two up quarks and a down quark. That's 2 × 2/3 plus a minus 1/3. That's a charge of plus 1, which is the charge of a proton. A neutron is made up of an up and two down quarks, which has a charge of 0. Let us suppose I want to make your professor a liar by finding a free quark which has a partial fractional charge. The way I might do that is I might kick the crap out of a proton and try to blast one of the quarks out. What happens when you do that is that they're held by the strong nuclear force, and as they move apart, the force between them actually grows, which is very strange. Right? With all the other forces you're used to, like gravity, I take two masses, I move them apart, the force between them falls off as 1 over r squared. The same for electromagnetism. In the strong nuclear force, the force actually gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And in fact, it gets so strong that there's a potential energy in the space between them that becomes so great that it's energetically favorable to pull another quark and antiquark out of thin air, out of the vacuum, that then joins these two that you're trying to pull apart. So instead of having a free quark, you get this quark with other quarks, and it ends up that you like get other protons and other types of particles. But you'll never see a free quark. Very bizarre stuff. So it turns out that there are particles in nature which we can see experimentally, because we can we can sort of probe these particles with very high energy other particles like electrons, and we can tell that they're scattering off of particles with fractional charge. So we have a lot of direct evidence that quarks exist, but you'll never see them freely in nature, so you don't really have to worry about them. Alright, so now you know all about it if you run into a quark in a dark alley some night. Why is it that way? I don't know. There's some local connections to this, I should add. You got your lab teacher, Professor Bodek. His thesis project turned out to be discovered quarks. When he was a graduate student, they were doing experiments at Stanford with very high energy electron beams and were able to see the scattering on targets of protons and neutrons, and were able to understand that it was all fractional particles inside the protons and neutrons. His thesis advisor won the Nobel Prize for that. So, sort of cool. That's one connection. We've also played a role locally. We had groups that were part of the discovery of the top quark only about 15 years ago, I guess. So, all right. But enough particle physics. You didn't sign up for that. So let's get back to electromagnetism. But maybe let's talk for a moment about chemistry. I would like you to think for a moment, talk to your neighbor if you wish, and I would like you to fix in your mind what you believe is the single most important number in chemistry. I know you stay up late at night thinking about this. But you have a lot of chemistry, so what do you think? I don't need the numerical value necessarily, right? But the quantity. Like, I don't want to hear 42 or whatever. Okay, what do you think? Throw something out there.
A mole.
Yeah. What? A mole. So something like Avogadro's number? Okay, Avogadro's number is pretty good. What else? Stunned silence, yes.
1.01 is the hydrogen molecular weight.
Okay, so mass measure, the hydrogen molecular weight. Yeah.
Quantum numbers.
That's a lot of numbers. Yeah? Yeah?
The atomic radius of a hydrogen atom?
Why hydrogen atom?
Isn't most theoretical physics based on hydrogen atoms?
Why is that?
Because we can solve the equations necessary.
Because we can do it, yeah. Alright, so all important numbers. I would throw out the number that I would say, which is the ionization energy for ground state hydrogen. Why? One, because we can do it, okay? It's also the simplest case, which is also why we can calculate the radius in quantum mechanics. If you can understand the hydrogen atom, which is the simplest thing, and that's what physicists do, right? I said dogs are nothing but electromagnetism and quantum mechanics, and that's true, but I can't calculate do a squat with dogs. So I say that, but I have to simplify the dog down to one hydrogen atom and try to understand that. And that I can calculate. And then you sort of begin to try to infer a lot of the rest of it. If you can calculate specifically for just the hydrogen atom, you've learned a lot, and then you can sort of either computationally figure out more complex systems, or you can sort of at least make them plausible. So if you understand the hydrogen atom and how it depends on the charges that are involved, and the hydrogen atom is nothing but a positive charge and a negative charge. That's all it is. So the fundamental force that's involved in holding that atom together is electromagnetism, or you can think of it as electrostatics, okay, basically. If I can understand what holds that together, I can imagine what would happen if I have a second charge in there, because it's just a vector force, and a third charge, and a fourth charge, and as I do this, I might have more positive charges and have nuclear. So you can imagine doing nuclear physics, and a lot of the pain that you get into in general physics is trying to figure out what happens when you throw quantum mechanics into the mix, which specifies sort of limitations on where these electrons can go. They don't all just go crashing into the nucleus, which is an amazing thing, actually, if you think about it, since all you have are these two charges. So quantum mechanics is really important because it keeps that from happening in part. But why I get excited about the ionization energy is that, okay, so what is the ionization energy of hydrogen? Okay, first of all, what is the ionization energy of hydrogen? Does anybody know? What does it represent? What do I mean? Yeah. So it's the energy it takes to take that electron out of the atom to infinity. So from a physics point of view, it is the amount of work it takes to grab that electron and pull it away to infinity. Okay. Why do you care? Okay. Maybe you don't. But why you should care is that's the simplest case. If you have a more complicated atom, it may scale by the numbers of charges and the distances a little bit, but it's basically the same thing. Okay? And what is chemistry? Chemistry is really nothing more than sort of a reconfiguration of electrons and these weird things we call molecules and atoms, right? What is a molecule? It's a bunch of positive charges sort of held stably together by the way that the electrons are set up, held in place by quantum mechanics. And chemistry is nothing more than a reconfiguration of that. And so all you're doing in chemistry is you're changing sort of where electrons are. You're removing them and you're putting them in slightly different things. The ionization energy of hydrogen basically sets the energy scale for all of that, right? The ionization energy of hydrogen is 13.6 electron volts. That means everything that happens in chemistry is going to be on the order of 10 electron volts in energy. Maybe it's bigger, but not hugely bigger, okay? And the only way to get more is to make more of it happen, right? You can get more energy out of something, but it's because you have more stuff in there doing its thing. So that's not always the case. If I do the same thing inside a nucleus and I rearrange nucleons where they're held together by a much stronger force called the nuclear force, the ionization energy for removing a nucleon from a nucleus is about 8 million electron volts. So if I take a bunch of nuclei and I rearrange them a little bit, everything I rearrange is now tens of millions of electron volts instead of tens of electron volts. And that is why if I take a little pile of dynamite and I set it off, I get boom. And if I take uranium and I set it off, I get kablooey. Right? That's the difference. And it has to do fundamentally with the differences in the energies of these things that you're reconfiguring. So the ionization energy of hydrogen is really important, and it sets the whole scale for everything that's happening in chemistry. It's the simplest case, and the reason that I bring it up is because even though this is only our second day in this class, we're going to calculate it. I know you're excited. Okay. I'm out of time. I have another half hour, right? Okay. All right, so let's calculate something. So let us suppose we have a hydrogen atom, and a hydrogen atom consists of a proton and an electron. And the model we'll use, because the electron is much lighter than the proton, is basically the proton is attracting the electron. We think of the electron as moving around the proton being fixed. And in fact, for simplicity, we will use more or less a model that Niels Bohr used. We'll talk about it much more later in the class. But it's one where you imagine that the electron is going around the proton in a circle, okay? Because that's easy to calculate. And in fact, we call this we would call it simply the Bohr atom. So the Bohr atom says that the electron moves in circular orbits around the nucleus, which isn't moving. The Bohr atom specifically is talking about a single electron atom. And if we look at such a thing, one can calculate the radius, which I'll call R0 here. We call this the Bohr radius. And I'm not going to calculate it now. We'll calculate it later in the term. But I'm going to use it right now. It's equal to 5.29 times 10 to the minus 11 meters. You've done enough chemistry to know that the ground state of hydrogen is more complicated than this, that the electron actually is a wave. You don't really think of it as a particle. And that all you can do is calculate probabilities. But if you were to calculate the average radial position in quantum mechanics, you would get this number. Okay? But in the Bohr model, the simple mechanical model, it's called a semi-classical model, because classical, because we think of these as little particles with one moving in a circle, so you can visualize it and calculate it because it's 1/13. Semi-classical because we actually take advantage of quantum mechanics, at least to the extent to say that it's stable. And which it wouldn't necessarily be in strict classical physics. Anyway, so the first question, just because it's sort of interesting, is these particles also have mass, so we can actually compare the size of the electrostatic force between them. And notice a thing a little fuzzy here, right? Because the electron is moving in this picture, and yet I'm still talking about electrostatics. So let's imagine, for the moment, we take a snapshot and we're looking at the force, but we're assuming it's moving in a circle. So we'll sort of take advantage of the fact that it moves in a circle, but we'll think of it as a static situation. So the first thing, let's just ask, how does the EM force compare to the force of gravity? Between the particles. So the EM force goes as this KQ1 times Q2 over R squared. K is 8.99 times 10 to the minus 9. And then we have both particles have the electric charge as their net charge, so it's 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs squared. And we divide it by the radius, which is 5.29 times 10 to the minus 11 meters. And that whole thing is squared. So that's basically how you calculate the electromagnetic force. And when you do, you get that this is equal to 8.2 times 10 to the minus 8 newtons, if I did it right. I'm not going to waste your time calculating up here. If we look at the force of gravity, then that would be equal to g times the mass of the electron times the mass of the proton over r0 squared. And you can look them up. I'm not going to bother writing them down. And when you calculate it, this ends up being 3.6 times 10 to the minus 47 newtons. So the ratio of the electromagnetic force to the gravitational force is 2.3 times 10 to the 39th. So I find it sort of interesting to think that if electromagnetism is almost 10 to the 40th times stronger than gravity, why is it this gravity that's annoying me all day? I mean, you go through the day and you hardly ever notice anything electromagnetic. It's really a statement about how neutral matter is. Right? You get a shock when you rub something on something else, and what you're doing is a very small fractional change in the relative charges. Right? And that becomes enough. If you take the balloon and you do this, it sticks to the wall. And you haven't actually put a whole lot of charge on there for that to happen, but it's much stronger than that. So the fact that you're just not constantly having to fight the electrostatic charge is because to a very, very large degree, matter is just simply neutral. You have it's mainly out of neutral atoms and neutral molecules and stuff. Okay, so next thing I think I want to look at would be in this model, what is the speed of the electron? The electron is moving in a circle in this model. That means we know we have to have a centripetal force toward the center. Right? So the moment that you see it's a circle, then you have to do the mantra F equals mv squared over r, etc. So you know that the centripetal force toward the center, because it's on a circle, is equal to the mass of the electron times the speed of the electron squared divided by the radius. So if we take the electromagnetic force that we just calculated and we set it equal to the mass of the electron, which you can look up, times v squared over the radius, which we've already said what it was, you can calculate the velocity of the electron, the speed of the electron. And when you do, you get that it's equal to 2.2 times 10 to the 6 meters per second, which turns out to be 1% of the speed of light, which is what I mean to see here. Okay? Are we having fun? Any questions? All right. So now, what you've all been waiting for, let's calculate how much energy does it take to ionize hydrogen. How would you go about trying to calculate that? Suppose I had a satellite and I asked you, to calculate the escape velocity for a satellite. How would you do that? I'm positive you did that last semester. You know, it always amazes me, because I have a column brain. All the crap that I learned in college. So I sometimes wonder, why do we do this to ourselves? Some of it sticks, the gist of it sort of sticks often. But to calculate the escape velocity, right, you're basically calculating how much energy it takes to remove it from a mass. Remember how you did that calculation? Thank you.
You said the force of gravity equals the centripetal force.
That would be what we just did to calculate its velocity. What did you do?
You realized that the initial energy is equal to the final energy, in which case you can know your point of view escape will be zero or both.
Okay, but you have, I mean, you have a piece in there which is, in physics what we do is we calculate how much work it takes. Remember work? Anybody heard of work? Okay, how much work it takes. Remember work is like energy, same thing, that it takes to remove it. Okay, and what is work in physics?
Change in kinetic energy.
Because it depends on, whether you have a conservative force or not, because you can have friction or whatever. But it's the integral of F dot ds. Remember that? It's sort of the force along the direction which you move it. Right, so if I'm a waiter carrying a thing of champagne, right, that's not work because I'm not moving it, and I'm moving it sideways to the force that I'm exerting to hold it up. If I do this or I do that, that's work. Right. So, okay. So what we want to do is to look at the energy, which is the same thing as the work it takes to remove the electron from this hydrogen atom. So the amount of work, let's try it very simply. Let's just assume, we're going to start out from a position which is this R0, that's the Bohr radius. And we want to move this thing out to infinity. And we want to ask, we want to exert a force to do that. And we'll take a path, which is sort of along this ds. So a ds would be some sort of differential little chunk of the path along which we pull this electron out to infinity. Okay? Probably way more so than we did in mechanics, we're going to talk about moving things to infinity, which basically means you move it away so far that the force is zero between them. Okay? And of course it doesn't really make any real sense, because what do you mean when you say I'm going to move this charge out to infinity? I mean, how can you do that? For all practical purposes, you can do it. Mathematically, we do it. So it's as if this distance becomes infinitely large. All right, so for simplicity, because the force is along the radial line joining these two, and gravity is conservative, what that means is it's path independent, if you recall. Right? I can calculate how fast somebody's going at the bottom of the slide if it's frictionless, and it doesn't matter whether they go this way or whether they go back down a very steep slide. Okay? Because it's just the change, and it's the end point. So it actually doesn't matter what path I use here, but to do the calculation, it's simplest if I just move it along the radial path. So what we'll do is we'll assume that we grab the electron, and we slowly just move it out to infinity. All right. So the force that I exert to do that, because it is being pulled toward the proton, is I exert a force out toward infinity. Okay. So this becomes from R0 to infinity of K E squared over R squared dr. So ds becomes dr because I'm moving out in the radial direction. Because the force I'm exerting is in the same direction as the dr because it's going out. All right, then the dot product F dot ds becomes F times ds, and the ds is a dr. So what force do I exert? I have to do it slowly, which basically means the force I exert is basically the same as the force with which the proton is pulling. Otherwise, I'm accelerating, and it's a different story. So I have to move it slowly out to infinity. So that's why this F becomes the electrostatic force, K E squared over R squared. ds is dr, and the dot product has disappeared because the two are in the same direction. You good with that? All right. So this becomes K, which is a constant, and E squared, which is a constant. They pull out of the integral. And then I do the integral from R0 to infinity of 1 over R squared dr. So this is K times E squared times minus 1 over R evaluated between R0 and infinity. Which gives me basically minus 1 over infinity squared minus a minus 1 over R0. This is 0, so this becomes K E squared over R squared, and it's positive, which is good. So not R squared, R0. When you are thinking about these types of problems, you always want to do a reality check. When you do, and you'll be doing this kind of stuff throughout the semester, all right? Just kind of moving charges around and trying to think about how the energy changes. So if you ever find yourself doing one of these work integrals, you'll note that all the trick is getting the signs right. I'm asking, how much work does it take me to remove that electron? That means the force that I exert is in the positive radial direction, pulling it away toward infinity. I'm asking, what does it take to take it from small radius to a large radius, which means the ds is going from small to large, which is along the radial. So those two vectors are in the same direction. That's really important to know, because that means the dot product is positive. Okay? If you screw up one of those signs, you'll get some negative number in the end. And so it's always good to do a reality check on this. Just sort of think, okay, what am I doing? Should it take energy, or should I be using energy to do it, or should it be giving me energy? I have to exert energy to pull that electron out of the hydrogen atom. So the net work that I should do better be positive, because I have to do work to pull it out. Okay? So when I go through this whole stupid calculation and I get to that final answer, if I drop the sign, I probably have a negative there. And if I see a negative, that would tell me that I have to, that energy is coming out of the system under it. Doesn't make any sense. But I know I'm putting energy in, so it better be positive. Okay? So always do a reality check. Okay, but now we actually have a number. And when we calculate this, we can now pop in 1.6 times 10 to the minus 16 coulombs squared, and we can pop in the number for K, and we've got our zero already, so we can calculate this. And when we calculate this, what we get is 4.3 times 10 to the minus 18 joules, because we're in MKS. And because in chemistry we're used to thinking electron volts as a unit of energy, and we'll talk more about electron volts. It happens to be the amount of energy it would take to move a charge of plus one from the pole of one side of a 1 volt battery to the other side, basically. That's what we mean when we say electron volt. But you've probably played a lot with electron volts in chemistry, and we'll talk a lot more about it. The number that I remember for ionization energy of hydrogen is an electron volt, so I want to convert this. 1 joule is equal to 6.2 times 10 to the 18 electron volts, or EV. So if I calculate this and convert it to electron volts, what we find is we get 26.9 electron volts. And a number that I hope some of you might even know, but you should sort of keep in mind, because again, it sets the scale for the energy of all chemistry, is that if you go and you measure it, you find that the ionization energy for hydrogen ground state is equal to 13.6 electron volts. So we're pretty close. I didn't invoke quantum mechanics in any way, really. That's not bad. What did we miss? What did we leave out of the classical picture? We're missing something. Ionization energy is the amount of energy that I have to put into that system to remove the electron. Total. That electron's already got energy. Right? Because it's moving. It's moving in this circle. What we calculated was the static situation of if the electron is not moving, and I have it close to the proton, and I calculate how much energy does it take to remove it totally from that situation. Because it's circling, it's already got some energy. So I don't actually have to put in that much energy to remove it. So we calculated a number that's too high. So we have to remove from our number, this 26.9 eV, we have to remove the kinetic energy of the electron. That is the energy that it already has when it's going around. So if we calculate what the kinetic energy of the moving electron at the distance r0, then we set 1/2 times the mass of the electron times the velocity of the electron squared. That would be its kinetic energy. And you know that earlier we calculated its velocity under the assumption it's moving in a circle. So we actually already have the velocity calculated. So this is 1/2. Turns out that the mass of the electron, if you look it up, is 9.11 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms, so not a great unit for electron mass. But and then we had calculated earlier, it's 2.2 times 10 to the 6 meters per second was the velocity. And when you calculate this, the kinetic energy of the electron, so you plug in the numbers, what you'll find when you convert it into electron volts is that this is equal to 13.6 eV. So that the ionization energy is equal to the energy removal, this sort of work that we did, I'll call this W, is equal to W minus the kinetic energy that you've already got. Ionization energy represents how much energy do I put in to remove that electron. If the electron already has some energy, I put in less. We calculated how much do I put in if the electron doesn't have any energy, but it's just sitting there by the proton. That's what we calculated. So it actually already has some energy, which is this 13.6 eV. So the actual ionization energy will be this static removal energy, this 26.9 eV, minus the kinetic energy that it's already got, which gets us to 13.3 electron volts. And if you go and measure it, it's actually 13.6. So this is really quite close. And all we've done is Coulomb's law. That's pretty neat, right? All of chemistry, right there. How about that? Next class, we'll do all of philosophy. I have a couple of minutes, so let me get us started on our next topic a little bit. So suppose we have a charge Q here. Think of it as a big positive charge. And let's say that I have a little Q here. I'll think of that as a test charge. When I say test charge, think of it as an imaginary charge with positive unit charge. But even if it's real. So what we've learned about the force of electrostatics, or electromagnetism so far, is that there's a force here. Okay? What is the essence of that force? What exactly is big Q doing to little Q to make little Q be repelled? You ever worry about that? I mean, you've done gravity now. Suppose we talk about two masses. What is the essence of the gravitational force? How does it work? Suppose I have just big Q here. And instantaneously, I pop down little Q. Is the force on it instantaneous? Does it take time to build up? What causes it? Say what? I couldn't hear you. The electric force. Well, that's what we call it. But what I want to know is, what is the essence of it? What do we know? We spend a lot of time quantifying it. But we need to construct a mental model of what is actually causing this force, whatever it is. And it's not all... well, we have to construct a model. It doesn't necessarily mean it corresponds to reality. There are actually different views of what is the essence of the force. Okay? And I may spill the beans on some of that as we go along. But let me stick to this for the moment. We need to invent something, because I don't know what causes the force. All right, so we're going to make something up. What we're going to say is that if I have big Q out in space over here, that somehow big Q does something to the space around it. Okay? Such that if I put a little Q there, there is a force on. All right? And what we say, what we'll say mentally is that big Q has in the space around it something we will call an electric field. So a charge emits an electric field, and an electric field, if it exists in space and I put another charge there, there is a force on it. So we're actually going to create a mental model and say that a charge changes the space around it by creating an electric field. And if there exists an electric field, then another charge will feel an electric force on it if it's inside that electric field. Alright? And so that's where we'll start next class, is to create this model. And I just want you to bear in mind one thing, this whole thing. We'll talk a bit more about it Tuesday. I am pulling this totally out of thin air. Okay, I want you to understand, we are completely just making up this idea of electric field. Because we need a model that sort of works. Okay? There's no reality to it.